the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, how you doing out there? It's Mark Frout. The show is Insight Thursday morning. Almost another week in our belt. I can smell Friday. It's palpable. Great weekend on tap. Love it. Got some good plans? Well, you know, sometimes it's good not to have plans. Anything's possible then. I'm going through some Olympic withdrawals. How about you? Totally. I was glued, if not watching it every night, reading about it incessantly. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. Also, you know what? This is not something I planned on talking about, but I took my son fishing yesterday on a deep sea fishing boat. He's 7 years old, so I thought, you know, it's about time we get him out in a big blue sea. And it was the worst conditions I've ever experienced. We had that 8 to 10 foot swells. So the reason why I bring this up, because I'm still getting my land legs. Yeah, my land legs, because it was so rough last night. The boat actually came in early. Anyway, I digress. It's a great show. Thursday, always give us a call at 800-874-4888. Make that 888-874-4888. So, you know what? We all think we have our fair share of problems, right? You know, I talk about overcoming adversity on the show, etc. We got a guest coming on the show next 15 minutes or so. He's like most of us. He uses a smartphone, his writing is impeccable, wears a watch, plays an instrument, drives a car. But there's one little difference.
I've always felt musical. It was something that was in my blood. I used to bang on pots and pans when I was like 3, 4 years old. When you've been playing the drums for 45 years and you imagined in your basement practicing to nobody that someday you might be in a studio doing a film, being here is something I'm still coming to grips with. It's surreal.
Unbelievable. Alvin Law was born without arms, and he is an incredible, incredible motivational speaker that I can totally relate to because this is what I do when I'm not here. But aside from that, he has just touched so many lives on 5 continents. I mean, millions and millions of people. He's been speaking for 30 years. He's just a major transformer. He has a great disposition, and he talks about the attitudinal revolution, and that's what we're going to talk about with Alvin in just a few minutes when he joins us live from Canada. And his influence is just unbelievable. You're going to meet him and totally fall in love with him. So I want to tell you about something that I had done last weekend, had no idea what I was getting into, but basically I think of this as how to become an Italian in 24 hours or less, because this is what happened. You know, this is not something we talk about on a show. This is not a cooking segment, but it's got a bigger macro picture and message to this. So bear with me, because obviously you're going to learn a lot, because I learned a ton. So I'm an Irish guy. You know, I've become a much better cook in the last 10 years. What's that guy's name that goes, bam? You know, I forgot his name. He's amazing. I'm not amazing. I'm decent. So my neighbors, who we've become very close with in almost 3 years that my wife and I moved into this neighborhood, asked us about a week ago, hey, do you want to join us to make some sauce? Now, they're from Italy. Great, great, loving people. Hearts of gold. Love them through and through. They have 2 kids, same as ours. And they said, yeah, we're going to make some sauce next weekend. Would you like to join us? I said, sure. Yeah, you know, it sounds like fun. You know, take off our shoes and socks and jump on some tomatoes and you'll be done, right? No, that's not the case. Of course, I'm thinking about I Love Lucy and making wine with, you know, crushing the grapes. So here's the deal. I had no idea what kind of involved process, how laborious this would be. So in the morning, I'm outside my house doing some things. And it's like 9:30, 10 o'clock. I hear some jars rattling. I'm like, oh, I guess they're starting to do some stuff. So I certainly wanted to be a contributor. You know, I didn't want to be like, oh, yeah, I'll be over in a couple hours, you know. So I go over there, and it's, you know, it's setting up time. So they're setting up tents in the driveway. So I'm thinking, this is beginning to look like the Feast of San Gennaro in Little Italy, downtown New York City. So I'm like, okay, this is pretty wild. This is a major production. So here we go. There are bushels and bushels of tomatoes that they got from Brooklyn that came from New Jersey. And that's another story, because I'm like, well, I could have gotten them for you right here, right? So we get these tomatoes. And so there's a multiple step process to this. And so the first step is to wash the tomatoes. So my son is helping with their two children wash all the tomatoes in these big, big vats of water. It's a two-step process because, of course, it's food. You got to be very cognizant of how clean it is. So we're doing this back and forth, and then one tub to the next tub. And then the very, very difficult task begins of slicing up all these tomatoes. So now, during all this time, we're having great conversation. We're in their driveway. It's, you know, steaming hot. It's probably low 90s. Two umbrellas, tents, I should say. But still, we have ovens behind us, these big, big boiler plates. They're probably about 12, 15 inches in radius that have the water boiling behind us. And so we're cutting. I'm cutting tomatoes for hours. I am not embellishing whatsoever. Hours, right? A few cuts in my hands, no big deal. But so it really dawns on me that this is a great tradition, a family tradition, a neighborhood tradition, like a community tradition. And what a great way to come together. Of course, you know, people invite each other over for food, drinks, and it's a great way to bond. But this is a whole new concept for me because, you know, real Italians. Zach, are you Italian? Zach is not Italian. Oh, he's semi-Italian. Have you heard of this before? Okay, so this is what real Italians do. They make their own sauce. And by the way, I always thought Italians called it gravy. No, they call it sauce. So the Americans who think they're trying to be Italian call it gravy, but I was corrected. So this is what they do. So we're doing all this, and I'm thinking about how fortunate I am to be included on such a close-knit event. So it goes on. So we cut the tomatoes, and I'm like, oh, great, great, great. So we put them in this big vat. Now, the vats hold about one or two bushels, so they cook for half an hour. You put special ingredients in it, which if I told you, I would probably be ostracized from that family and the block, and maybe from New Jersey and from every Italian, so I'm sworn to secrecy about what they actually put in their sauce. But if I get to know you a little bit better, I'll tell you, okay? Shh, shh, shh. So anyway, so that's cooking. So after it all cooks, okay, then it has to be jarred. All right, so we put them into jars, and it's going. Now, this is, I'm abbreviating hours worth of work here, hours worth of work. So this happens, and so we put the lids on the jars, and I think that's it. Presto. Done, right? No, that's not the case. So what happens next is the jars have to go in tubs of water. You know, they just steel tubs used to wash your, or still probably do wash your dog or cat in outside. They get filled with water. And you put the jars of sauce in there, and they boil. And what happens is they become vacuum sealed. So they can stay fresh for a year or two. Because when you open a jar, you know, like I'm opening, you know, used to opening Ragu jars, Classico sauce, you know, all the things that are loaded with sugar. So that's the other thing. I'm getting an education, of course, on eating healthier. So all this time is transpiring. And I'm thinking about, this is so cool. At first, I'm thinking like, wow, this is going to take a long time. My friend Nick, the husband was like, yeah, we'll probably finish around 10, 11, 12 o'clock tonight. I'm like, oh my God, that's a long time to make sauce. I can just drive down to the store and buy like 20 jars for you and be back in 10 minutes. It's not going to be that hard. But it's much more than that. I love the fact that they think that much of us, to include us in such a incredible event that combines food, love, you know, community, and so much more. So yeah, it's a long and hard day's worth of work, but it's something that you can relish for a year. So the sauce is in there, and then we do the jars, and then I left around, so I'm there like 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. I leave around 5, 6 o'clock at night. Just take a little break, go home, do some emails, et cetera, have a little bite to eat, come back an hour and a half later, something like that. I think they all probably thought I took a siesta and was never coming back. But of course, I showed back up. And the wife, Rosa, her brother was there, and he made some homemade pizza, which was incredible, unbelievable pizza, one of the best pizza I ever had in my life. And then the process continued. So it goes on and on and on. So I leave around 10:30 at night, and everything's done. We're cleaned up. That's a whole nother production, I should say, where you have to clean everything. You know, you got tables, you got big vats of sauce, et cetera, that you have to clean up. So the boiling of the jars goes on until I think probably 11 o'clock, midnight. But the reality is, it is just an incredible, incredible event that just kind of blew me away. And it just left an indelible impression on me. That what a positive experience to have. I mean, Rosa and her two kids, my two kids, you know, putting sauce in jars and cutting tomatoes. It's more than that. It's a great bonding event. And how incredible it will be. And what a heartwarming memory for all these kids and for us to look back in 5, 10, 15, 20 years and say, remember when we made 220 jars of sauce in a couple hours? 220 jars of sauce. Yeah. So the good news is, well, actually all day long, Rosa and Nick were both kidding me, saying, like, Mark, you're working so hard. We think you're going to get like 2 or 3 jars of sauce. I'm like, hey, take your time there. I mean, that's a bold statement. I think you should just really think about this slowly. Sorry, I had to take a tea break there. I had to think about this slowly because, you know, I'm working all these hours. Maybe I can get 5 jars of sauce. So that's my story about how to become Italian in less than 24 hours. But it's not done. Because the other day, evening, I was doing some yard work with my son, Luke. And sure enough, I see Rosa and her two kids coming down the street, all dressed nice, smiles on her face, as usual. And they got jars of sauce. And so they come up to me and the two kids start, I'm like, whoa, guys, I got three cases of sauce. I don't need any. And Rosa's like, no, we're actually giving these out to all our neighbors. So take this a step further to all the other neighbors in the neighborhood. There's only about, I don't know, 15 houses in our neighborhood. But they took the time to, obviously, they spent 15 hours making this sauce, to hand deliver jars of sauce to some people that, you know, it's just a casual wave a couple times a month or throughout the year that you see driving by your house. But to knock on their door and say, hey, enjoy this bottle of sauce homemade with the, you know, joy and passion and painstaking hours that it took to create, and we're giving this to you. I mean, what does that say about a person? It speaks volumes about the time commitment, about caring for your neighbor. And I don't want to get on some all crazy higher level Pollyanna-ish, you know, religion, because it's not about that, because I belong to the Church of Decency. I don't know where that belongs, but for me, it's just who I am. You want to be decent to the people that you live with and are nearby or interact with or strangers on the street, because I believe certainly you want to be treat people the way you want to be treated. When I give my talks on various topics, I mean, that's the reality of it. We're all pretty much the same people, right? Just shaped by our experiences. That's really it. I mean, you know, some of us have very, very positive experiences. Some of us have experienced more unfortunate experiences that aren't that great and can be negative and can leave certainly an indelible impression on you. But it's what you do with those differences that define you, right? So whether you want to become an Italian in less than 24 hours and make your own sauce, here's the recipe, which I'm not going to share with you. That's how you do it. So that's how I spent my last Saturday. And I wanted to share that with you because I just think it's very, very incredible on many levels because, you know, it's something that you can do for yourself. You don't have to go through the major production of going out in your driveway and having vats of sauce and, you know, 20 bushels of tomatoes. And by the way, I was remiss in saying that my cousin Bob was a hero that day because he's a farmer who, and is the biggest heart in the world, biggest heart, such a gracious and gregarious, affable person. I called him and say, hey, we're running short on a little tomatoes because some of them are a little bit soft, whatever. He stopped his tractor. He called up his friends who are fellow farmers. He came over here with 3 cases of tomatoes. So Bob, if you're listening, you got a case of tomato sauce coming your way. Yes. Thank you for that. So that's another way. It just really kind of pulled the community. We got farmers calling farmers saying, hey, do you have really ripe, you know, plum tomatoes? And that's how it worked. So if you just joined in, the show is Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. Happy to be with you today and all the time. And if you ever want to check out any of the shows that are on our podcast or in the archives, just log on to prn.fm and go into either the host page and see myself, Mark Farrell, or under the archives and look for the show Insight. So I was telling you about an individual last week, and multiple individuals, because as we lead up to the Paralympics, the Olympics obviously are behind us, and I'm a little crestfallen because I love watching it. But as you know, if you listen to me, you know I'm a bigger fan of the Paralympics, because as a disability advocate for, you know, 20 years or so, and a person with a visual disability, and more importantly, a person who loves to cycle, I really gravitate to the incredible athletic feats performed by so many people. And one of my colleagues, Michelle Spitz, brought it to my attention last week. There was a great commercial that aired in Canada for the Paralympics. And it starts off a little bit like this.
I've always felt musical. It was something that was in my blood. I used to bang on pots and pans when I was like 3-4 years old. When you've been playing the drums for 45 years and you imagined in your basement practicing to nobody that someday you might be in a studio doing a film, being here is something I'm still coming to grips with. It's surreal.
And that's the voice of Alvin Law. He's my guest. I'm so happy. I am over the moon excited, I should say, to bring Alvin Law to the show, direct from Canada. Alvin, how are you doing, my friend?
Mark, I'm awesome. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I love the video. And by the way, not to correct the host of the show, but this video is actually going on all around the world. In fact, I got a Facebook post the other day from a friend of mine in London who went out to see the new Jason Bourne movie. And just before the movie started, the trailer, the 3-minute version of it with the song and everything, hit the big screen. And he was joking, saying, "I've never seen your feet 30 feet high."
That is great news, Alvin, in movies as a trailer lineup. That's fantastic. Good for you.
Yeah, they're also going to be showing it in Rio starting, I think, sometime just before the beginning of the game. So, you know, for what it's worth, man, you know, if people haven't seen it, probably the easiest way to get to it, and this isn't to do self-promotion right off the start, but it's just easy to find off my website at alvinlaw.com. But, you know, you hit the nail on the head, brother. It's not about me. It's about the bigger picture, not only of the Paralympics, but you know what your and my journey has been, eh?
Absolutely. And actually, we shared a very similar journey early on, but you were the smarter guy and got the hell out of it. So you owe very much a great deal of gratitude to the United Nations because they pulled you out of the world of radio.
Yeah, you know, I had to laugh, man, when I looked at your website and saw your background, and I thought to myself, my God, you and I have something in common. Going into the radio business, using all of the old equipment, I was in radio from 1978 to about 1981, and, you know, there wasn't really those days where you'd use computers like you have now or have an operator like you do now. You had to do it yourself, and that was, you know, spinning vinyl and editing reel-to-reel tapes with razor blades. Imagine that, doing that with my toes. I can just imagine you doing what you did with your situation. So, yeah, it's funny. Radio was a great one, but radio was a great way to learn how to communicate. But I'll be honest with you, I did radio at first because I wanted to hide from the looks that I got being so unusual, having no arms. And it just occurred to me that I was hiding from myself, and not to get into cheesiness right off the start. But that was one of the biggest things that happened to me, was getting out of radio and going into the public speaking world, where not only could I show my talents, but to make people have a rethought about exactly what they see when they see someone with a so-called disability.
Alvin, were you cognizant of it back then, or was that something that was more subconscious, hiding behind a microphone in a closed dark room?
I think I got tired as an adolescent because I didn't have the life confidence yet to realize that who you are is not your physical being. Who you are is much deeper than that, and who you are is something that you should be able to see from a different perspective once you start to really, you know, I know people might see this coming, but, you know, once you start to invoke acceptance, gratitude, and even more importantly, understanding that you can be a teacher to people, you can't do that hiding in a room. You have to do that by going out in the public and not only showing your talents, but speaking your story. And I think that's one of the things that you and I both have in common as well.
And that's how you execute your attitude revolution to over 2 million people. So explain to me the genesis of the attitude revolution.
Well, I'll be honest with you, that's the clever thought process of an excellent writer in Toronto, Ontario, that I hired. But I wanted her, to be quite frank, take a look at me from a different perspective. I know what I'm capable of. I know what I've done with my life. But I want people to understand that this isn't just about me. This is about the incredible power. And if anybody knew this, Mark, you would know this, that it's not just positive thinking because it's a great marketing tool. It changes how you view your challenges. It changes how you view, you know, overcoming the big things in your life. I know when a lot of people listen to these shows, they probably roll their eyes and go, yeah, but that guy doesn't or that gal doesn't have to live my life. Mm-hmm. Got it. We've all got something to get over. But what I think I wanted to make sure people understood is it's not just something that is a personal thing where if, you know, one person gets a good attitude, good. One person gets a good attitude and it becomes infectious, then you start to change the entire complex of a small town, of a bigger city, and you know what, even Mark, an entire country. I really believe that. And I know what, I got to be honest with you, I don't want to get into politics with you now, but your country's in a lot of trouble because all I'm hearing is negative.
Well,
you know what's wrong with that? America's a great place.
Alvin, before we go any further, how big is your house? Do you have any extra bedrooms there? Because my wife and family,
home, and we do have extra bedrooms,
because
I'm expecting an influx of immigrants from the United States. Oh, I'm so kidding.
Absolutely, but I am not, man. We are at a dodge here. We're going to have to take PRN to another location. Anyway, I digress. So talk to me about the palpable feeling that you get when you're in a room, whether it's five people or 5,000, and about, because it's so different from radio. You and I are speaking one-on-one, and we're talking to, you know, maybe hundreds of thousands of people over the world right now. But again, Radio 101 is you're talking to one person, and that's not actually any different when you're in a room, right?
No, and to be quite honest, I have to tell you that I had to learn this. I knew it was awesome being in front of an audience, but I had a great educator in my wife, Darlene, who really kind of took me aside. And my wife, Darlene, actually is a feng shui master, and we won't get into the details of that, but if people want to look up feng shui, she understands, and she actually does this for part of her living. She runs our company, too. But she can measure energy. She can go into a room, and she can measure the energy in a home or an office, a building. Mm. She can also measure people's energy, and it's a skill she's acquired, but it's out there for everybody. And if you've ever been in a room full of really hyper-positive people, you know that the energy bowls you over. When you're in a microphone, in a studio with a microphone, you can't feel the personal energy coming through the airwaves. You can sense that people are listening. But that's what I noticed was the most powerful thing, is you get up in front of a group of people. But also, conversely, have you ever been around a group of people that are just negative? You know, they're always negative. They got nothing good to say.
Black
clouds. That is also a powerful energy. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, I tend to be in rooms where the positive energy exists in the first place because that's where my gig is. But I like to think that, you know, that's not exactly where the road ends. You just keep on doing this over and over and over and over and over again, and you end up with momentum. And, you know, I love it. It's not just an ego boost, though, man. It's what I do for a living.
Well, it's the best kind of natural high you can get. I'm an athlete, and I love the feeling that I get after a workout or a competition. And I compete with myself. I don't compete with other people more, even when I'm in a race. But the reality is, when I leave, my wife even says to me, man, you come home beaming when you're after speaking, whether it's just one event or multiple events in one day. I could be exhausted, of course, just like you understand, but it's what you leave, that indelible impression, even if you just connect with that one person in the room, that gives them that one kernel of hope or inspiration or motivation to either change something or to think about something in a different manner.
So I'm gonna make this real simple, and I'm pretty sure this isn't original, but I've been talking about it for years. I believe there's a simplistic way of looking at this. People are really in two categories. You're either a giver or you're a taker.
Mm.
And I don't want to preach to people, but if you've ever given, like you talked about your sauce, giving stuff away, teaching kids to give things away, there is a different psychology in giving than there is a psychology in taking. And I don't mean taking in the sense that if you need, you know, financial assistance, or if you need to go to the food bank, or if you need to go get help from somebody. That's not taking. But a lot of people out there are takers because they think the world owes them something. And I think that's where the heart of you and I come from, frankly. I don't want to speak for you, but my parents taught me you will not be given things in your life. It's tempting because you could get all kinds of special programs. You got no arms. That just didn't work for me, you know. And again, I'm not judging people who do. I'm saying that for me, earning it was the biggest thing. And that's what actually being on stage is the same thing. I'm giving my personal story, my personal energy to an audience member, and you hit it the nail on the head, man. If one person goes home and, you know, treats their spouse or partner better, treats their kids better, treats their boss or their employees better, then aren't we accomplishing something that we all set out on this goal for in the first place?
And your birth defect originated because your mother was prescribed a morning sickness medication, which was very popular back then. Obviously, it's been removed from the market, and I think 13,000 or so babies were affected back then. But it left you with no arms, and you were obviously given up for adoption. So, but
yeah.
The upside was you landed in an incredible family environment. Your mother, Hilda, and Jack were responsible for, you know, teaching you to use your feet as hands, and sort of like the rest is all history.
Well, I grew up in a small town in Canada, too, which I think also added to it, and that was actually part of the dilemma of my birth. My birth family were just too overwhelmed by my having no arms. But I'd like to take this to a different idea, and that is the whole idea of thalidomide was one of the first times we had a huge influx of birth defects during a very small time frame. Mark, I don't know if you can relate to this, but I've studied this, and I'm fascinated by it. Isn't it intriguing how America in particular treated the veterans coming home from Vietnam, you know, throwing things in their face, calling them terrible names? And now we look at our veterans who have been to war and call them wounded warriors.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different mindset. Thalidomide was like the first batch of people being born where society looked at us and went, oh, that's the grossest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Lepers.
Because when we see people missing limbs or having contorted limbs or deformed hands or feet, it just makes us uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
You know, I know it must be interesting for you, brother, because when you walk around, people don't necessarily know that you have a sight impairment, right? So you can almost hide. When you got no arms, you can't hide. Everybody looks at you. So what's changed in society to me, and that's the most important thing, is the stigma that came along with thalidomide is what sent me to live in a foster home because they just wanted to hide me away. Well, my foster parents weren't like that. They weren't about hiding me away. And I know this sounds almost perfect, but it was. I live in a small town when I was growing up. I was out doing things, riding my tricycle, going to school. But most importantly, I learned to play music. I got into band. I mean, I was out there doing things. And when I discovered that I could do certain things physically, what that did to my emotional standard and, as you know, to my mental health was huge.
Oh, of course. I mean, it must give you so much empowerment. And the fact that your foster parents informed you at a very early age, there's no such thing as can't do or the word no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, can you imagine how weird it was, not to take this back to the original subject, but
sure.
When I was asked to be in this video playing the drums and the song was Yes, I Can.
It's great.
Oh, my God, I heard that song when I was a kid. My dad used to play it for me and say, see, it's not just us.
That's great. Now, did you have other siblings or foster brothers and sisters growing up in the same household?
Not that I remember. My parents actually started, having them take them off the list once I was about 2 or 3 years old and realizing that I was going to be a pretty full-time job. My parents were in their 50s. That's another very important part of the
wow.
story. Mom was 55 when I was a baby and dad was 53. So I actually have a brother who's 84 years old that was raised in my family home before I came along. They were both gone, so I was raised really as an only child, but I am definitely treated as a third son in the family. And my parents are both passed away now, Mom in 96, Dad in 2001. But you know what? I think the biggest thing that we were all had in common in our family was you have responsibilities. I remember when my mom first said to me when I was about 9 years old, time for you to start doing the dishes. And I imagine I looked at her and went, what? How am I supposed to do that? Mom's answer was, I don't know, you're the one without arms. You figure it out. And a lot of people think that's cruel, but no, it wasn't cruel. My parents loved me to death. And if I can just make one little editorial comment,
sure.
We do not show our children love by doing everything for them.
You're right. That's such a misconception, certainly in the United States, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, we bubble wrap our kids, and I understand
yes.
we care about them.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a now 31-year-old son. He just turned 31 on Tuesday. I can't believe it. I love him to death, but one of the greatest things that I learned from my parents was to let him make his own mistakes and learn from them and move on.
Do not enable.
No, and again, that goes to this idea that when we can teach our kids, they've got everything in their life
mm-hmm.
already there. They can enact whatever it takes out of their whole being. They can make their own, not only make their dreams come true. I think that's a bit of a red herring when you say, oh, make your dreams come true. Let's remind ourselves in the Paralympics and even just the Olympic Games that we're just on are a perfect example. No, you don't get there by wishing it. You get there by practicing and practicing and practicing. I mean, you know from triathlons, those aren't easy. But boy, when you're done, whew, what a feeling.
Yeah, especially when you go to the fridge and crack open a nice cold one. My guest is Alvin Law. He's a professional speaker, author, just an incredible fundraiser, subject of 2 TV documentaries. And here's a piece of Alvin.
I stand against people that have not been able to get over stuff. That's probably the one that bugs me the most. I had to get over blaming having no arms on whatever wicked monster was out there creating my life, because the irony is whatever it was that made me this way is what gave me the awesome life that I've got. If people could just see the opposite side of what they complain about, then they would live life with more joy, with more abundance, and with more success.
And it's interesting, back then when you were in school, certainly when I was young as well, segregation for persons with disabilities, and they used to use the H word back there, handicap, was
yeah.
quite rampant. But for you, fortunately, you were mainstreamed in all your school, all the way through college.
Yeah, actually, that story gets a little bit lost in 2016, Mark, because, of course, we assume that, you know, children with that H word, yes, handicaps have always gone to regular schools. Absolutely not.
No.
I mean, that's like assuming women could always vote. Isn't it amazing? See, I tend to be a little bit too perfect and happy for people. Like, I annoy people because I'm so joyous about my life. I'm joyous about my life not because I'm a motivational speaker. The life came first. The speaking became the career. Everything that we did was about breaking new ground. In 1966, I went into the Yorkton, Saskatchewan school system, and there had never been a special needs, quote-unquote, child ever in their history. And, of course, everybody's kind of going, gee, we've never done this before. And my mom and dad are going, really? Yeah, exactly. So if we've never done something before, isn't this a good time to try it? So, yes, that helped, but not because it made it easy. That's a very important thing, Mark, really. And this is not to discourage any idea of special education. You know, we've got a lot of challenges in our education system. But for me, knowing that the world was going to be difficult and knowing that I had to play by the same rules as everybody else, that changed my mindset. So I didn't go through school thinking of education, ready for this, as a right. Every day when I went off to school, I understood what a privilege it was. And if I forgot, my parents would remind me.
Well, that's
a fight to get you in, and we should be thankful for that.
That's a very astute attitude to have at a young age because, you know, like regardless whether you have arms or no legs or whatever, the reality is you're a kid. You're a kid first. And
yeah,
to be in an environment, such a positive, nurturing environment, you know, obviously has led you down that path where you've been obviously succeeding for many, many years. And that's pivotal because it all comes down to parenting. The environment, what you put in is what you get out as a parent. And it's so true. And speaking of what you experience in school, it's just great that you were they're excelling, and I'm sure you had a lot of very, very challenging, tumultuous times in school. Didn't play many sports, correct?
You know what's funny is, no, I did not. And in fact, the irony of it all, can you imagine? I mean, I've used this joke for 35 years. It's still funny, I suppose. I loved soccer, or as my dad, who was actually an immigrant from Britain, called it football. And as we've just seen in the Olympics, it's actually called football, but I digress. I loved soccer. And you can imagine how good I was at soccer with the talented feet, my body control, my strength, my core. And I never got the penalty for touching the ball with my hands. I always have to throw that one out there.
But
I couldn't play sports. And you know what? I played sports with my friends until sports became competitive. And you know what? And there's nothing wrong with that. I got to be honest. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, sports should be for everybody. I guess, except you also need to make the team. And that's not about excluding people. It's about understanding we need to earn our way onto something. And that's when, you know, in terms of getting involved in sports, I realized, and it hurt a little bit, but that's when I got involved in the opportunity to play music. And that, to me, was my sport. You know, I often say that my Olympics were playing the trombone with my foot and trying to be the best. And frankly, this is maybe not in the bio information, it's a bit of an old story. In 1978, I was Canada's number one ranked high school jazz trombone player.
Wow.
And not the handicap kind, the all-school kind.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Now, how did I get there? Well, I got there because I wasn't dating, I wasn't popular, I wasn't hanging around corner stores, I wasn't out getting in trouble. I was downstairs practicing my bloody trombone for hours at a time. Did I love it all? No. But when I got to compete and win and sometimes not win, the pride that it gives you in yourself, and maybe, Mark, you can relate to this, self-pride does not come from the makeup you put on in the morning when you go out to work. Self-pride emanates from inside out, and that's what I learned from music. It was a huge teacher.
How do you see yourself when you look in the mirror versus when you were 15 years old versus now? Do you see your eyes, your face, or do you still see a person without arms first?
You know what? I see a smile, and I got to be honest about
great.
This. I know this sounds really full of myself, but that's what people talk about when they remember Alvin Law. They go, "Yeah, that smile. Like, is it real?
Infectious."
Okay, so let's do a visual now, Mark. And I know sometimes visuals are a complicated thing for you, but I'm sitting here in the living room of our summer cottage in rural Canada, looking out at a beautiful lake. We're right on the edge of the water, and I'm on an upper deck, so I can see the entire lake. I'm sitting here watching my wife, Darlene, who is just a beautiful woman and spirit in my life, sitting on the front deck with our two dogs, including a nine-month-old puppy. Talk about breathing life into a place. And it just, I'm so blessed. And that's not a religious statement. I heard you talking about that earlier. It's just how lucky could a guy get? But at the same time, this took a lot of work, and I'm proud of that.
And speaking of work, it wasn't all easy for you, obviously, not just being without arms and thinking that you can snap your fingers and 30 years later, you're an incredibly successful motivational speaker. You worked for the government. You weren't happy about that. You had a great job, paid very, very well. You had another marriage that failed. And possibly, was that a marriage that failed because of maybe you weren't comfortable and maybe you didn't marry the right person because you thought possibly that maybe you should just accept somebody for who's accepting you?
Do you ever? Does anyone ever call you a genius, brother?
No, you're the first.
Very, very perceptive. I've talked about that for years, but then I kind of stopped talking about it because there's only so many things you can talk about in a format of a speech. Absolutely. You know what? Let's use a perfect example of a subject matter for about a second here. People are always trying to up their bar, raise their bar, use the expression you're comfortable with in their work, in their recreation, in their hobbies. But how often do we raise our personal bar in our personal relationships, especially our partner in life? So many people just settle because they think they're not good enough. That is exactly what happened the first time around in my life. I settled because I just didn't think that, in my case, a woman would want to live with me for the rest of my life. I did get into a relationship, and unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it was not a good relationship. It did, however, fortunately, produce that child. And that child actually was a bigger challenge in my life than ever, having no arms, because when he was 5 years old, I became a single dad because his mother had her own mental health challenges, and she had to let him go. So she and him have not been associated for probably 20 years. And I was a single dad. I don't talk a lot about that because I'm not an expert on this subject. I'm not really an expert on anything, man. I like to talk about life. But you know what? When I met Darlene in 1991, she and I just hit it off. And she was also in a marriage that did not work. When we got together and got married in 93, I think the entire world on both sides of our camp were just cheering because they kept going, finally, they found each other that they totally deserve. And I know that sounds so romantic, but oh my God, when I raised my personal bar, I raised everything else in my life.
Wow, you just gave me a lot to digest there, Alvin. And number one, it's really daunting, I imagine. Number one, to decide to leave somebody, and I'm not exactly sure how the separation set, but the reality is you would be alone with a five-year-old child with a major disability. I mean, number one, obviously just being a single parent alone, and back then, you know, being the male role and being the major upbringing, the parent of a child was certainly uncommon back then. And then just, you know, realizing, am I ever going to meet somebody? Now I'm even a little bit more challenged because I have a child and I still have no arms and I have no idea what I'm going to do with my life.
Yeah, so you know what it was, Mark? This is a nugget. And I think people have heard this before, but this is my favorite nugget. It's all about who you spend time with. Okay, this is not a reflection on my ex-wife. She knows it's true. She knows that this is the way things work. In her environment with her friends, they were complainers. And we know the type, you know, you get around somebody that you get around for 30 seconds, it was 25 seconds too long, right? You ever been around them?
Oh, these are black clouds, man.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I was in. I got actually sucked into it. It was like a vortex. I didn't realize I was getting sucked down this tube because I was so desperate to be with somebody that I would do anything. But, you know, honestly, you hit the nail on the head. I sat down with a friend of mine after I split up. And by the way, when I split up with my ex, we'd only been married a year and a half. We knew that the writing was on the wall right away. So my son would have barely been three. In fact, not even three. I sat out actually on this very lake that I'm looking at right now with my lifelong friend from my teenage years out here. And he was the coolest guy at the lake. You know, he was a water skier. He could barefoot ski. He had long blonde hair. He got all the girls, and he wanted to hang out with me. I mean, really? You know why? Because I was a great water ski boat driver. I'm a great driver. I was a great boat driver, and I could drive on this lake and know exactly where the best lines are for the best water skiing, especially barefooting at sunset. So can you imagine that picture? We became the best of friends, and we sat down together in one of his boats that weekend after I got divorced. And I said, what am I going to do? And he goes, change your crowd.
Wow.
What he said, change your crowd. He goes, you look at the crowd you used to hang out with, man. They were life lovers. You know what? You had a lot of friends who were girls. They just didn't want to date you. Don't take that personal. Keep on finding good friends, male, female. But hang around with the different crowd that makes you feel better about yourself, doesn't make you feel worse. I mean, isn't that such an obvious line? And why are so many people afraid to do it? Well, man, because we're insecure. We're afraid to leave things that we think are security because we just don't know what's out there in that world of doubt. But I got to tell you, there's too many stories, not just ours, man, but everybody's out there that are successful that say the same thing. You know, change your crowd, change your attitude, change your life.
Change your job, man, like you did, your industry.
Yeah, whatever. You know, a lot of people are scared to quit.
Absolutely.
I get that.
Hey, change is scary, no doubt.
Well, you know, I don't know if you can relate to this, man. I bet you can. When you have a so-called handicap, I think it... And this is, I hate the stereotype, especially with visually impaired people, that all your other senses increase. That's not what I'm talking about. You get connected to your soul. That's what I find. You know, when people look at me, they go, oh my God, he's got no arms. That must be terrible. Absolutely not. The having no arms has made me very connected to my inner being. And when I trust that inner being and I want to make a decision on whether I should do something or not, I just let my gut go and then say, you know what, trust the gut. It'll always be right because you got to have a little bit of faith in that place that you've never been before. And that's how we experience new things.
Very much so. Is there anything that you are kind of taken aback or daunted by in terms of trying new things? I mean, you drive your car, you drive a boat, you shave, you do all these different things. You write, as a matter of fact, there's a great clip on your website, alvinlaw.com. That's alvinlaw.com, where you actually meet a little boy, probably 10, 15 years old, who's also born without arms. And you compare how to write techniques. But is there anything?
Yeah, he's actually six.
Oh, six?
Yeah, he's a big boy, but he's six. Yeah, there's a really good example. Okay, so that little boy grew up and was actually given away because he was living in a First Nations community on a reserve in Canada, and you know, it's a sad story, to be quite frank. His mother was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and his grandmother took him in and started to raise him. And you know, when he came to meet me, it was at a teacher's convention in Winnipeg, Canada. And his teachers that are looking after him brought him along because he knew I was going to speak. He'd never met an adult human being without arms. And in 30 seconds, we bonded. And in 5 minutes, I was teaching him how to write a little differently, because that's one of the things I learned. How you put your pen between your toes, you know, is a very big part of this. And it was a joy teaching him. But you see, that's exactly what I remember. I didn't do this alone, man. You know, that's the other thing. We're not talking about a solo battle. You know, if people are thinking about what messaging to take from this interview today, you're surrounded by people that are there to help you. All you got to do is ask.
Infinite
and
resources.
You know, I think that's the greatest lesson, isn't it? When you don't have any arms, I'll give you a really blunt example, all right? When I had no arms in high school, the hardest part about having no arms was I couldn't go to the bathroom myself. I want the audience to picture that. Picture what you complain about, and then look at your hands and don't use them the next time you go to the bathroom. Seriously, don't use your hands and see how far you get. And people would say, well, that'd be impossible. It's not impossible. It's just a reality check. I finally figured out how to do it. How to personal care myself was with my flexible legs and feet. But how to dress myself was simply getting altered clothing. But I didn't want to have altered clothing. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to wear jeans. I wanted to have the latest Levi's, you know?
Mainstream, baby.
Yeah, but I had to wear polyester pants with elastic waistbands that I called granny pants. Well, nobody when they're 17 and a boy want to wear granny pants, until my mom basically sat me down one day and said, granny pants or I keep coming to school to wipe your butt.
Okay, there they are. Granny pants, bring them on. I'll take 10 different colors. Here's another.
So I hate to be crude here, man, but that's exactly what I faced every single day. So if you can imagine realizing, you know what, that's my mom challenging me again, not because she didn't want to help me, but because she knew that she wouldn't be around forever to do exactly that. The more she could teach me my own independence, and that came with a bit of a cost of vanity. Whatever. You know what? Vanity is a dangerous thing, man.
It does. You know, I have a slogan, my difference makes me stronger, and it's so true because we all have things we excel at. And a lot of times we take it personally when we can't do sports or can't fit into a club or a clique. But the reality is I couldn't excel really educationally. I couldn't see boards. It took me longer to read, et cetera. So I carved a niche for myself. Believe it or not, I got very good at carpentry. So I took a lot of classes, was making like decks at home, et cetera. You wouldn't think so. But I found a niche that made me feel very whole where there would typically be a void because I put too much stock sometimes into all the things I couldn't do. But the end result was I found a niche for myself, and that catapulted me to or through actually difficult times.
And you created something.
Physically, yeah.
Isn't that something? No, really, we shouldn't make that light of that.
No,
when we can create something that we can look at. You know, I hear this all the time. People say, oh, all I do is
push paper.
Yeah, push paper. Or even worse, all I do is do sewer lines, or all I do is drive a bus, or all I do is work in this job. You know, whatever. We can't define ourselves by the things that seem mundane. We have to find things that we can connect with people, and that's where, you know, if we're not happy with our job, fine, volunteer. You know, go to a homeless shelter. Go where there's, abandoned pets. Go where there's people that need a little bit of assistance so they can give you a sense that you're creating not even a widget or a project, but something that you have contributed to. That's a huge part of it.
And here's another way Alvin Law connects with people.
My wife and I were in an antique store one day. We're cruising around. She's on one side of the store. I'm on the other. These old guys are following me around. I know they're looking at me because every time I look at them, they pretend to be looking at something else. I came around a corner. There was a pair of mannequin arms on a bookshelf. So I grab one under my chin because that's how I carry stuff, right? I shouted across the store, Darlene,
I may have found them.
I love it. That's great. That's priceless.
That's a good one, isn't it?
It really is. It really is. Was there any time in your life where you had a lot of animosity, anger, and blame about your mother putting you up for adoption, and or did you ever reconnect?
Excellent question, brother. You're good at this, man. You know, no, never. I was never angry with my birth mother. I had animosity towards the world for being an adolescent, but welcome to reality, teenagers, huh? I mean, that's just how it is for so many people. No, honestly, I wish I could make this stuff up, but I can't. The attitude in our home was always very open. Let's remember, this was the 60s and 70s. We didn't have open adoptions like we do now. It was a huge secret. I had to keep it a secret. My parents had to keep it a secret. My birth family could not reach out and touch me. And remember, we're in small town Canada. So, you know, they actually lived in a town just down the road about 20 minutes. But they knew where I was. They knew who I was. I was in the public eye. My parents made me understand that they did not give me away because they were mean-hearted or cruel. And I mean my parents that raised me. A lot of people say, well, you're real parents. No, sorry. It takes more than giving birth to earn the title mom, all right? My mom and dad were as a real parent to me as anything. But what I did understand, and this is going to sound, again, pretty well thought out and great wordsmithing, but I always understood why somebody would not be able to take me home. I never understood why somebody would want to. That was the nugget again. Why would someone take me home? Well, mom and dad, always very humble, very religious themselves. Oh, someone had to. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Can you imagine, let's get honest now, how hard this was? Like, I think that's what we sometimes forget when we see people, especially that have overcome physical challenges. It's hard. You know, you were talking about the Paralympics. Oh, my God. When we watch those Paralympics coming up in a couple of weeks,
Wow. Let's
remember that every single individual that is competing was competing with something else before they got into sports.
And
right?
even
I
just
mean, that's just the bottom line.
Oh, absolutely. And, even just the physical task of getting to the games.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, at the end of the day, when I met my birth family, to answer the second part of your question, in 1993, I did. I did it because my wife was the key to this. My wife being Darlene, the one that I've been married to for 20-plus years. She got to know the story of thalidomide. And the story of thalidomide, by the way, just to talk about it for about 10 seconds, was, I often say this, the babies were called the victims. I disagree. I think the moms were the victims. They were given this medication by doctors. Everybody thought it was safe. This is a long time ago. This was before testing and regulations and FDA, you know, let this thing slide because they just didn't see the problem with it.
There's got to be immense guilt associated with that.
Yeah, the guilt. The huge guilt of the moms. So here's the deal. My birth mom had guilt. My mom that raised me didn't have any guilt. But my wife said, you still have to go find her. Why? To just say sorry. If I've caused you any problems. To say thank you for giving me away. To say, I'm good. I hope you're okay. And I'm thinking to myself, really? I'm going to do that for someone I've never met? Absolutely. You know, how many times have you on your show, Mark, talked about the power of forgiveness?
Never.
You know, we only got one life, man. We waste all this time having grudges on things that we have no control over. No wonder people are bitchy.
Yeah, man.
Growler,
exactly.
You know
no. It's a short ride, man. You got to make it work for you.
Yeah, and so I met her in 93. I met her, by the way, because my birth father died in 1982, directly because of alcoholism caused by the drinking that started the day that they came home from the hospital without me. So when I got to know my birth brother, Alan, who's 4 years older than me, my birth sister, Elaine, who's 2 years older than me, they told stories of how horrible it was growing up in a home with a child who wasn't there. It was almost as if I died, and that grief that went on, you know. But I didn't let it get me. I didn't let that make me feel guilty because that wasn't my choice, right? Mm. So sad it's that some people have these lives, but so glad I had mine.
Alvin Lowe, let's talk about the physical ramifications because obviously, how tall are you, by the way?
I'm about 5'8".
5'8", okay. Yes. You must be... have an incredible physique. You must have abs of steel because everything you're doing, your core is the mainstay.
Yeah, you know what's funny is I never really thought about that when I was growing up. I never thought about having physical strength. But that's where the drums really came in because if you can picture when I sit behind a drum kit and I used to, you know, I was never really in a band per se. I played trombone in school band, but I played in a lot of garage bands and, you know, sort of weekend bands and stuff. But it was more just the practicing in my basement. I didn't realize what I was doing at the time by sitting on a stool with nothing on the back, supporting myself in like a V. If you picture me, I'm
sure,
sitting
you're
in
teetering.
Like a V shape. Yeah, I'm actually probably doing yoga without even realizing it. You know, 1,000 crunches a day. Absolutely. My son, this is funny, when he was a little boy, he'd invite his friends over, you know, to play and stuff, and they'd meet me, and they got to know me after a while, but the big joke was, you know, punch Alvin in the stomach or punch Vance's dad in the stomach because they thought it was hilarious. I got a huge core, and I think that was the key.
What about being nimble? I guess you don't have to do any stretching because everything you're doing is maneuvering and being and keeping your nimbleness, I say.
Yeah, but you know what? It's a choice of being active.
Sure.
There's a story that kind of goes with the thalidomide story of the early 60s, and that is there's a lot of issues happening now. And in Canada, by the way, in the United States, if anybody wants just a technical answer, there were only 23 thalidomide victims in the United States because the FDA never licensed the drug there.
Interesting.
I misspoke earlier. They were asked to, but they never did. And then it was banned by the World Health Organization, so it never got to that point. But there was about 125 Canadians. There's only 89 left today that were born with limb deficiencies because of the drug. Many of them were not blessed to have the life that I had. They were kept at home. They were hidden from the public. They never went to school. Therefore, they never learned to take care of themselves in a fitness way. Now, I'm not a fitnik. I don't go running because I find that's really hard on my knees. I'm looking at getting a recumbent bike because I need to keep my cardiovascular a little bit better. But my mind is active. I'm always doing something, and therefore the body stays active as well.
And here's one more clip from Alvin Law.
To think that somebody can live life without arms, that must provide some clues. And I just like sharing, just like helping people get better. You know, improve their lives. And I've been doing it since 1981, so I don't think I really got to pick. It kind of cheesy, but it picked me, really.
That's great. It's unbelievable. You know, and it's so evident in your voice. I mean, if no one ever saw you in a clip or even read about you, it's so palpable in who you are and everything you say and how you emote everything. So when you were 17, was the notion of driving on the table, or did you go up to your mother, Hilda and Jack, and say, listen, take me to DMV?
Oh, man, I heard you drive, too, and I'm thinking that must be fun.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, you should see the looks I get at red lights.
What's that?
You should see the looks I get at red lights because I wear glasses like a surgeon wears with telescopes on the outside. James Bondish.
Can you imagine me at a drive-thru?
The both of us in a car would be a sight to see.
I steer with my right foot on the wheel and my left foot on the gas, and I don't have any special equipment in my car at all, and that is a key to the story because
In
1976, it was actually 76, I was 16 years old, I got 100% on the in-class training portion of our driver education program at our public school. And if you can imagine, I was just Alvin in public school. You know, I wasn't this amazing guy. I wasn't this inspiring figure. I was, oh, yeah, that's Alvin. And, you know, I drove because that's what you did. So when I took in-class training, it was like everybody else. You know, you take your test. You figure, okay, that's a red light. That's a green light. I can answer that. But when I got that 100%, I also got a learner's permit in the mail, in our case, from the government of Saskatchewan, because nowhere on the test did it have any questions about, by the way, do you have arms? Right? I mean, it just didn't ask that question. So I get my learner's permit in the mail, and I'm, of course, excited and stoked, just like everybody else my age, and my parents are saying, okay, if you're going to learn to drive, you know what? We can't afford a driver education thing. We don't have any kind of money like that. So, you know, I'm sure there are people cringing at the thought of this story. Whoever let their dad teach them to drive? Isn't that fun?
Woo!
So my dad was my teacher, and what a hard ass. I mean, he didn't give me a break on anything. So when I went to take my test to get my license, that's when the bureaucrats got a little weird.
Hmm.
And it wasn't because they were being mean. It was because, hey, dude, we've never done this before. We don't even have a requisite for this before. We don't have an idea what to do with you. So essentially what it was they had to take away my learner's permit because they weren't sure if it was legal.
Interesting.
So I got all in a huff. I was 16 years
sure.
old. It was probably the first time in my life I ever stood up for myself. And I said, fine, what do I have to do to get my license? And I think they were patronizing me when they said, well, you have to pass the test. I said, fine, test me. Oh, we don't have anybody qualified for that. I said, your boss isn't qualified, the head of the department? Well, him, yeah. So I think they thought they would blow me off, come to Yorkton, my little town, you know, take the test, to say, you know, sorry, can't give you the license.
Sure, pat you on the head and say, have a good day.
Yeah, which kind of happened a few times in my life, right? You can relate.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I passed the test. He was a great guy, man. He gave the same standard to me that he had to give to everybody else because
sure.
that was very important for his ethical treatment. And I got 100%.
Good
for you.
In
fact, when we got back to the building, he even made me parallel park in front of the testing facility.
Great.
And I remember
great.
I was driving a car with standard steering back in those days, no power steering because
wow.
we were poor.
So,
yeah. So anyway, when I got my license, it was like the happiest day of my life. But there's another example. I never take my license for granted.
Oh, you and I both. I got my license at 25 when these glasses became available, and actually I got 100% as well, and it's actually on my office wall in a frame.
Nice.
So in the essence of time here, very quickly, I'm trying to picture your blinkers on American cars, which I'm sure they're the same as Canadian cars, are on the left-hand side, but you drive with your right foot. How is that possible?
I hold on to the steering wheel for the brief second that I need to change the light signal. So it's just kind of reach in between the whatever kind of car I'm driving and reach over with my foot and just flick on the light one way or the other. And it's, in fact, it's another way that I adapt myself, too, in terms of if I need to change the heat. But you know what? I try to, can you imagine how funny this is, man? I mean, I'm obviously trying to avoid the humor, but you just can't avoid it. I try to have as many things in my car hands-free as possible.
Yeah. I mean, in this, I say to audiences, there's never been a time. Nobody wants to be disabled, but there's never been a time on this planet to be disabled with technology as it is.
Well, you know, it's funny. I got to tell you, I'm not trying to name drop here, but I ran into and met Steve Wozniak, who, of course, was very responsible for the computer world. And we met at a conference I was speaking at in Singapore, and he came into the green room, and I was using my toes on my iPad. And he just stopped and just stared, and he was actually quite embarrassed. I said, it's okay, you can look. He wanted to take some video because he said he wanted to send it, as he called it, his words, the nerds at the Geek Lab in Palo Alto. And when we started chatting about it, he said, you know what? I'm wondering if you've ever thought about how much this technology has changed your life. And I kind of went, yeah, because I used to have to type on an old school typewriter. That's how I learned when I was a kid. So imagine what that technology means, tactile, for my toes. And that's changing the life of so many people with disabilities. You know, technology is something we take for granted because it's awesome.
On so many levels. Well, yeah, my friend, you leave audiences on a high note all the time, certainly in a real way. Your credibility, your positivity shine through for the continents, for the millions of people's lives you touch. And it's no surprise, my friend, you are incredible. With or without arms, I imagine you would be this way because it just seems it's in your DNA and you're a fighter and you let nothing hold you down.
Well, you're very generous in your words, man. I really appreciate it. And by the way, I walk through every single day of my life with the highest degree of humility that I can own because I realize I am blessed. You know what? My mom used to say growing up, man, this was not an accident. Someday you will understand your worth and your reason for being. And it's not just speaking. You know, it's being on shows like this. It's encouraging people out there that might be facing challenges of their own. And I'm sure that's what motivates you too, man. It's just, let's try to make the world a little better corner. And if we can make a little better corner, maybe we can make a bigger place.
Yeah, and it's smelling sweeter every day, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know what? We got to keep at it, though, because
absolutely.
We can't let them get us down.
Yep. AlvinLaw.com. That's AlvinLaw.com. He's been an incredible person. Great guest. And keep giving to all the millions of people that you've been working with every day, Alvin. My name is Mark Farrell. The show's been Inside. We're running out of time. Gary Knowles, kick me out of the studio. Have a great day.